Initiate countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Pleasure to welcome you to your friendly drive-in theater. For the information of those who are attending the drive-in for the first time, the following hints will make you feel at home and add to your enjoyment. Firstly, if you've not already done so, remove the speaker from the stand and place it in your car. Secondly, adjust the volume control to suit your requirements. Right for loud, left for soft. We must issue this warning. No attempt should be made to disconnect the speaker. To do so would immediately register a red light in our control room. One final word. Before leaving, replace the speaker on its stand, then drive forward and move to your left. You must never reverse out of your position. Thanks, everyone. We trust you have a very pleasant evening.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number one. My name's Terry Frost and this time around I'm flying solo. I know I said I would have guests for this podcast, but I'm flying solo for this one because of scheduling conflicts. And yeah, it's the start of the second phase of my podcasting empire. I really kind of want to let you know what the podcast is going to be about, how I'm going to format it, what we can do with it, and how it all works. So I'll just get on with that. Okay, for a start, I realise that MDIP is going to share the RSS feed with Paleo Cinema Podcast. You get them both or you don't get any of them. Unfortunately, I can't afford both feeds at the moment. If people want to go to the paleo-cinema.com website and throw some money into the PayPal account, then I may be able at some stage to differentiate the two RSS feeds by having different hosting. It's going to cost about $100 a year for podcast hosting, and I can't afford to do two of them, unfortunately, with all the other expenses that I've got. So I'm going to keep them on the same one. They're going to alternate. We're going to have one episode of each one per month. So every episode after this one, I'm going to have a guest. I'm going to work it out. I'm going to get my shit together. We're going to have a guest in each episode after this one. And I'm also going to shed the trope of only reviewing old movies. I'm not going to be only reviewing old movies in MDIP. I'm going to be going with newer stuff as well, but I'm going to try to find things that are a bit quirky, a little out of the way, aren't exactly mainstream science fiction movies that everybody's talking about. I want to kind of go into the niches and find those really interesting things, even if they're not perfect. What isn't going to change, though, is I'm still going to do homework for each episode. Still going to give a wider context for the movies I talk about. That's an important part of why I love doing podcasting, giving myself a good brain workout while I do it. This raises, of course, the question of why do it? Why do two different podcasts? After Paleo Cinema reached 100, I kind of got the urge to try something new, to do the next thing, in capital letters. For a while I was doing... For me, doing the next thing was doing the radio thing in ABC Local Radio Darwin with Ivor Cole. I'm still going to be doing that. We've had a couple of week hiatus, but we're still doing that one. And I love doing it. It's really great. I love doing something else with someone else. I like having that broad audience that radio gives you. But I wanted to do something new with my own projects, and Martian Drive-In Podcast is that. I want to give it a space age vibe, kind of, you know, that rocket ships with Studebaker fins, spacesuits with bubble helmets, ray guns, antennaed aliens, moon bases. And as I was thinking about that kind of stuff, working my way around it, the image of a drive-in movie theater on Mars came about. I don't know why, but that kind of combination of 1950s, 1960s, Googie architecture, retro style, with the one planet in the solar system which is box office poison to Hollywood. So I kind of like having a kind of retro future with a soundtrack by Martin Denny, Les Baxter, Leon Theremin, and Juan Garcia Esquivel. So that kind of a vibe. So once a month, it's Martian Drive-In Podcast. Once a month, it's Paleo Cinema Podcast. And I hope we do get a lot of crossover with the audience, too. I'd hate to just have people liking the alternate podcasts. The Paleo Cinema, I'm going to have a totally different vibe for, if I can manage that, from the Martian Drive-In. But we'll see how that develops. And if people have ideas on how I can differentiate the two of them. I'd really, really like feedback. Same email address, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. Happy to take them there. I may start an email address for the podcast itself, but we'll see how that goes as things develop. And, I really want people to be a part of this. I'm going to get guests in. I'm going to get people who are knowledgeable in the science fiction genre who can really kind of bring their A-game to it and help out with that. We'll see how that develops, but I really want to kind of get into that and get that happening. I may get Paul Polton back. I had him on an episode of Paleo Cinema. And I really want to kind of see whether Paul wants to have a go at that, because I did enjoy having a chat with him, and it's always nice to do a podcast with somebody you can arrange a meet-up with in town and kind of get a bowl of Vietnamese soup with, which both Paul and I tend to like. So that's how it's going to be going. I'm going to have a little bit of a break in just a few moments, and when I get back, I'm going to be doing the first of the new features for the podcast, which is news from the planet Mars. Things are happening with all of the space probes we've got around Mars and the landers we've got on Mars and all sorts of other things. And when I say we, I mean the human race, because I'm talking in a broader context than just nationalism here. I want to kind of see what kind of groovy things we're discovering about the planet Mars. And each time I do an episode, I'm sure there's going to be tons of stuff that I can bring to that and just kind of really groove with the idea that we are still exploring space, even if it is by remote control vehicles, actually. And that's it. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, we're going to do the news from Mars.
Here's the breaking news from the planet Mars.
Okay, it's not breaking news I'm going to do for the first one. I'm even going to break that at the start. It's actually historic news from the planet Mars. So riddle me this, Batman. When was the first probe sent to Mars? You got to remember, Sputnik 1957, Mars landing about 75, 76. When was the first probe sent that went past the planet Mars? It's earlier than you think. Dig this. 1962, the Russians launched Sputnik 23 towards Mars. You got to remember, this is 6 years after the original Sputnik. It's 2 years after Yuri Gagarin spun around the Earth a couple of times. So the Russians sent a space probe out to Mars, just as a publicity stunt more than anything else. All it had on it was a bit of a radio beepy thing. So problem was, half the distance to the moon, Sputnik 23 lost its lock on the Earth. It couldn't aim its antennas back at the Earth, so they don't know whether it had gone bung or whether it just lost track or whatever it was. But here's the cool thing. Sputnik 23, is known as Mars 1, passed within 193,000 kilometres of Mars in 1963. Cool thing about that is, this is around the same time that Elvis Presley was making Fun in Acapulco. So basically, the earliest attempts to do something like an exploration around Mars was 1963. Kennedy was still alive when it happened. I thought it was a lot later myself. I thought it was years later. I thought it would be like 68, 69, something like that. But no, 1962 launch, 1963 it passed within about half the distance of the moon of the planet Mars, which I think is kind of cool. And it's a little bit of an unknown bit of history. So out there somewhere towards the edge of the solar system by now is a tiny little Russian Sputnik that can't find its way back home. So that is the news from Mars for the first episode. The fact that 1963, the Russians, not the Martians, but the Russians, sent a probe at Mars, missed it, and it got lost.
Satellite loses orbit. Will it strike your house? Film at 11.
What I haven't done so far in the podcast is mention the movies that I'm going to talk about, which is a bit remiss. But if you're following on Facebook, either you can friend me up on Facebook, or you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You would have known that the movies I'm going to do are, first off, First Men in the Moon from 1964, a kind of proto-steampunk epic based on the H.G. Wells novel of the same name, and also a 1968 movie
by MGM, produced by George Powell, directed by Byron Haskin, called The Power, based on a science fiction novel by Frank M. Robinson. So we're going to do both of those ones. And while I think of it, I should also mention, I don't want to sound like Sean Connery, I also want to mention that there is a specific blog now for the podcast. If you go to marsdriveinoneword.blogspot.com, there will be links and stuff I write about science fiction movies and stuff like that. Update on the podcast itself. So I've kind of got two blogs running. I've got the paleo-cinema.com. I've got the marsdriveinoneword.blogspot.com ones, and I'm going to cross post between the two just to kind of keep that connection there. But I'll be doing things like the trailers for the movies that I talk about, because very often there are trailers available on YouTube that I can embed on there and put those in to give people a bit of a flavour for it. And also there are increasingly large numbers of public domain science fiction films which are available in their entirety on YouTube. And I'm going to be posting those on to that site as well. I've done it already somewhat with the paleo-cinema.com website, but I do want to do that as well and kind of give people the opportunity to check out some films they might not have seen otherwise, and just kind of add a little value to the blog itself. So first movie I'm going to talk about, I'll go in chronological order, we're going to look at 1964's first Men in the Moon. I'll just play the audio from the trailer for that and then get into why I think it is a groovy movie.
Ever since time began, man has been fascinated by the mystery of the moon. But over 60 years ago, writer H.G. Wells anticipated the shape of things to come with his fascinating adventure, First Men in the Moon. The story of the first men to bridge the 250,000 miles between heaven and earth. This is how it began.
This is a solemn moment in the history of mankind.
We're off!
Just as I predicted, shot into space with the speed of a bullet.
First Men in the Moon. An experience unparalleled on the screen as two worlds meet and clash.
Come on! Help me, come on!
First Men in the Moon, starring Edward Judd, first human to set foot on a strange new world in space. Martha Heyer, the first woman to experience the indescribable dangers of this other world. Jeffries, who discovers an empire beyond imagination. First Men in the Moon. Filmed in Dynamation. Dynamation, miracle of the screen, captures the whole marvelous, miraculous story of man's first journey to the moon.
Oh, it makes all other forms of power obsolete. That's where they're getting their power from, sunlight.
You will discover human ant-like creatures H.G. Wells called selenites and giant gastropods.
Cover, run!
Fearsome moon monsters to be hunted and killed. You will encounter another world of eerie beauty and infinite mystery.
Soon others will be coming from Earth. Our galleries will be strewn with dead.
I'm the only one who holds the secret of Cavorite.
Then you and your secret will remain here on the moon.
Cavor! Cavor, this is not an audience. You're on trial!
No, Bedford!
No!
Convicted!
We'll be right back.
Of course, that trailer does have all the bombast of a 1960s adventure film trailer, where they do tend to head towards hyperbole. Not a bad film, this one. It does have a script by Nigel Neal, who people remember from the Quatermass series in the 50s, and who went on to do a lot of interesting work in later years, things like The Stone Tape in the 1970s, which is a scientific ghost story that is incredibly creepy, and also things like The Year of the Sex Olympics, which I like to do in the podcast too. It's an interesting thing he did for TV, where he basically invents and foretells reality television in a lot of ways. So it's not one of Nigel Neal's best works, but it's interesting that they did get him into work on the script. The director was a guy called Nathan Duran, who was a Romanian emigre. He came over when things were getting a little... Actually, didn't he? He came over in 1912. His family immigrated to Minneapolis. And he got a degree in architecture and was very kind of an artistic bent. He was art director on How Green Was My Valley. But as a director, he did specialise in genre works. He did a western called Drums Across the River in 1954. But the other films he directed, Deadly Mantis in 1957, one of that great cycle of giant monster movies, 20 Million Miles to Earth, again another one where he worked with Harryhausen. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad in 1958, he worked with Harryhausen on that. And Harryhausen, of course, did the effects for First Men in the Moon. The Brain from the Planet Arras in 1958, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman in 1958, Jack the Giant Killer in 1962, and the only thing that I recall him directing after First Men in the Moon was a Kirwan Matthews werewolf film called The Boy Who Cried Werewolf in 1973. So he was kind of a jobbing director, did live a long time. He died at the age of 95, which is not a bad little run, in 2002. So you know, he was he had a lifetime career award in the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films in 1999. So, and he did work a lot in television, mostly for people like Irwin Allen, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Lost in Space, Land of the Giants, that kind of thing. So he was a jobbing director. Not incredibly distinguished, but he got the job done kind of thing. And the stars of the movie are quite interesting. Lionel Jeffries, of course. Now, if you go and take a look at the Trailers from Hell thing that John Landis did about this film, John Landis does mention an interesting fact about Lionel Jeffries. He, of course, played Grandpa in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And Lionel Jeffries was younger than the guy playing his son, Dick Van Dyke. He was one of those guys who, because he was bald and because he had a certain kind of facial configuration, played a lot older than he was for a lot of his career. One of the things I remember him from was he played a bald Arab in, I think it was The Vikings, with Richard Widmark. So a little bit of an unusual role there for Lionel Jeffries, but people remember him from a lot of the children's movies he did. He did direct The Railway Children too, an interesting children's film in the 1970s. So he's one of those guys that people who saw the movies he was in from an early age do have a great fondness for him as an actor. Very fine actor, a good writer as well by all accounts. And he really kind of brought a Victorian-era eccentricity to the role of Professor Cavor, who invents Cavorite, the material that he uses to travel to the moon. It blocks gravity the way that a blind blocks light. Not exactly scientifically accurate, but then H.G. Wells did write the novel in 1901, and there wasn't too much... You couldn't really go to Michio Kaku at the time and just ask him what... You know, what's what. So, yeah, and it does have a beautiful Edwardian thing. I don't think that the love story works particularly well in this film. Though, of course, you do have to have one. You can't just have two guys going off into space because it might be considered homosexual. You know how people had that kind of instinctive fear of perception in those days. So we've got Edward Judd, a good jobbing character actor. Went bald very early, and it's always interesting looking at Edward Judd films just to see what kind of rug they give him. They give him a particularly good one in this film. It's got a little bit of a widow's peak and a little bit of a forelock on it, and does a good job. People might remember him from a very fine science fiction film from a couple of years before this called The Day the Earth Caught Fire that he did with Leo McKern and Janet Munro about the Earth, because of atomic testing, slowly circling closer to the sun. Really well done. It's all set in London, set around Fleet Street and newspapers. And it's one of the best science fiction films of the 1960s, though. And I don't think this one particularly is, but I've got a fondness for it because, it's one of those films that you see as a child and that you retain a fondness for, which, of course, is the only reason people really like Star Wars. But this one is great. I do like the spaceship they do. It's kind of like a kind of polyhedral spheroid shape made out of, it looks like it's made out of railway track and train bumpers, which are used to kind of buffer the sphere. And it's got a good kind of Isambard Kingdom Brunel look to it, which works really well. They've got a hatch which kind of looks like a submarine hatch. The interior is quilted and decorated in quite nice Edwardian style. I'm not too sure how Cavor got someone to do the interior fittings, but they're all kind of brass and quilted soft furnishings looking in. And it does have a nice style to it as well. The other person in the film, there's actually two other people that I'll mention, but what the other one is Martha Heyer, playing the mandatory love interest, an American actress, who a couple of years after this film went on to marry the producer Hal B. Wallace, and they were married until his death a number of years later. She was kind of like a starlet who, at the time this movie was made, she was 40 years old, so she was kind of past the starlet stage and was a kind of struggling actress. Hal B. Wallace, you might remember, was the producer on a lot of those Elvis Presley movies from the 1960s, so he made a lot of money from that. But Martha Heyer is a kind of attractive woman, but not really a great actress. I think she was put in there basically because they needed somebody who the studio had, I think it was Columbia Studios, had under contract, so they grabbed her, somebody who was about the same age as Edward Judd, and it kind of worked. She was playing it a little bit younger, but I don't think it particularly worked. But the Edward Judd and Lionel Jeffries dynamic is a much more interesting one than between him, and he's a bit of a con man, the character Bedford, played by Edward Judd. He's kind of living on his wits a little bit, and it's nice they didn't make him a kind of upright citizen. He kind of scams the sale of the cottage he lives in, even though he's only renting it, and he's had a few business problems in London, so he's moved to this little cottage out in the sticks in England. And they do try to characterise him a little bit more than you'd usually get in this kind of film, and he's a bit of a rogue character. The only other person I'll mention is a bit where a bailiff comes in and hands a summons to the character played by Martha Heyer, whose name is, he said, looking it up, Kate. See, not very memorable character at all. The only other person is the bailiff, which is an uncredited role. Peter Finch played the role. Now, Peter Finch was a very big actor at the time. Of course, he went on in 1976 to win the Oscar for Network. But it's nice to see him doing a little kind of slightly comical character piece as a bailiff's man handing out the summons to Martha Heyer. The reason Peter Finch did it, he was in the studio that day, and the guy who was supposed to play the role didn't show up, so Finchie just decided to go in and do this little bit of work, a day's work there, and just have a little bit of fun with it. I've got to mention the frame story around this movie. There's a frame story when sometime in the near future of 1964, a UN space probe manned, because there's only guys in it, of course. It's 1964. Women weren't allowed to go into space in 1964 unless they were Russian. An international crew go land on the moon, and it just so happens, and this is one of those coincidences you get in movies at this time, they just happened to land on the one piece of the moon where 60-odd years before, Cavor and Bedford and Kate had landed, and they find a Union Jack and a little note claiming the moon for Queen Victoria. So that then leads a search to see if any of the people are alive, to see if there are actually people there, and it's not just one of the astronauts pulling a prank on the rest of them. And they find a very old Bedford in a nursing home, And he tells the story of their previous trip to the moon. And it's a lovely little framing device. It's one of the bits of the film that I do like, the fact that when people do reach the moon, they find out somebody had got there before them by quite an unusual method. And the old age makeup's not particularly great for the film, but Edward Judd does make the character work as an old guy and as a younger guy pretty well, because he was quite a good actor. And he tells the story, and then, of course, there's this flashback to the time when he was living in Cherry Cottage and meets Cavor, the eccentric scientist who lives next door. So it's, it kind of does have that lovely, there's a beautiful steampunk feel to this. It's pretty steampunk, of course, but I think people who are into steampunk would find this film quite lovely. And the special effects for the selenites on the moon and the giant moon cow, which is an enormous caterpillar that the selenites use for food, were done by Ray Harryhausen. I don't think it's particularly Harryhausen's best work. I'm not sure they gave him too much time to do it either. There are only a few scenes featuring Harryhausen's creations. Most of the time, the selenites are played by children in kind of insectoid costumes. And in spite of that, it does kind of work. There, of course, are limitations to these kind of things with budget and the technology of the day. Now, any movie you watch before CGI really hit its stride, you've got to consider that the special effects are going to look a little bit quaint. The sphere going to the moon, for instance, there are matte lines around the sphere as it heads towards the surface of the moon. Having said that, I think it does work kind of well in the way they do it, given the limitations of the time, and you've always got to consider those. So it's a good little rollicking adventure film. It's one that people who saw it as a kid do have a great fondness for. It. There's nothing particularly bad about it. I think that one of the problems, of course, at the time was they tended to gear these films towards the kid market a little bit, so there are some tiny bits of silliness in there. And it shows how much better science fiction film gets when you take the genre seriously. And I don't think that occurred up until maybe Blade Runner. I think there were moments of it where, in smaller ways, things were taken seriously. But I don't know whether the respect was there before that. In many instances, I think 2001, you've got to consider that as being kind of Kubrick tossing off on the genre a little bit. I think Kubrick's conceits regarding space travel and things like that make it a film that has dated badly, but I can talk about that another time. But First Men in the Moon, a good 1960s programmer, an interesting pre-steampunk effort. It's got Harryhausen in it, and people love Harryhausen's work. Again, the special effects are quaint. It's got the H.G. Wells connection. There was a new version of this done in 2010 for the BBC by Mark Gatiss, who people might remember from The League of Gentlemen, amongst other things. And it's quite a good adaptation. His one is has even more of a steampunky feel than the First Men in the Moon from 1964, and I recommend people find that. I'm not sure how you're going to find it. You may have to actually dip into the dreaded and much feared by the industry BitTorrent to find it, but I recommend that you do. It's again, it has a television budget, so there are limitations, but the CGI works. And I kind of watched them back-to-back once, when it first came out in 2010. I watched the Mark Gatiss BBC First Men in the Moon along with the 1964 one. And they're nice companion pieces. I don't think one dismisses the other. I think they really do kind of work well. And again, there's a framing device, but a somewhat different one, which takes into account the real-life moon landings. So I recommend that you check out both of those. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the second of the two films, which I think for me is a slightly more interesting one, which is the 1968 MGM movie, The Power.
For instance, Cavorite trays and boots. Boots? Yes, of course. Simply enamel the soles,
and a man would just like that. Hey? Cover?
That's right.
Oh, good, good. Yes, I thought of boots last night. Army surplus boots. You know, it's one of those basic ideas.
The only way to do it, really.
Well, perhaps not the only way, but for a start.
Don't see why we shouldn't do it together. Room enough in the sphere for two people.
Oh, now, wait a minute. You're not serious about that idea of going to the moon, are you? It was a joke, wasn't it? I mean, we'd just be firing ourselves off the globe for nothing, absolutely nothing. I mean, if there was anything on the moon worth discovering, there might be some...
It's exceptionally high in minerals.
Minerals?
Minerals.
Including gold?
Including gold. Mind you, there is a theory that the minerals on the surface of the moon are not in a molten magma, but dotted about in nuggets. Rather like raisins in a fruitcake. That's better than weightless boots, isn't it?
Let's talk about The Power now. It's based on a 1956 novel by Frank M. Robinson. He's still alive, by the way. He's 85 years old, but he's still alive. He started out as an office boy for Ziff Davis and got involved in writing pulps in the early mid-20th century. Well, it would have been about 1940s. And he was one of the people who co-wrote one of the two books that became The Towering Inferno. He co-wrote a techno thriller called The Glass Inferno with Thomas N. Scorsia. And that was combined with Richard Martin Stern's The Tower to produce The Towering Inferno. But, yeah, Robinson is still alive. Well, also, one of the interesting things about him was in the 1970s, he was a speechwriter for the gay politician Harvey Milk, who then went on to become, of course, as we know, Sean Penn. But, yeah, and Robinson wrote a novel called The Power, which was... Let me just see if I can get a synopsis of the movie, because this one's a little bit hard to describe off the cuff. Okay, after a bit of a search, I found one. It's from RottenTomatoes.com. A team of research scientists believe they have discovered a superior intelligence. Jim Tanner, played by George Hamilton, and his partner Marjorie Lansing, Suzanne Plachet, have discovered the entity through their work on human endurance. The Power is able to control the minds of others, but Jim cannot substantiate his suspicions that the Force comes from one of the members of the scientific community. A series of murders has Jim under suspicion by the police, and as he tries to uncover the identity of the killer, the mysterious Adam Hart. Okay, the movie also stars Yvonne DiCarlo, Earl Holliman, and Nehemiah Persoff's in it, and Arthur O'Connell, a bunch of other people as well, including Richard Carlson, who people remember from The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I'm just going to play the trailer from this one as well, and just see how we go from there.
Is there any limit to the power a man could have? Should he discover the key to unlock the unknown? What strange power for tomorrow lies untouched within us? One of these men has the power. A power strong enough to invade other minds, to make them act against their will, to terrorize, to kill, to control the universe.
Genetically speaking, it's entirely possible to produce a man of tomorrow right now.
What? He thinks we're all being watched.
By whom?
By the unknown. As a matter of fact, by the super unknown.
The power baits a trap with danger and disaster.
There's something about you, something different from us.
Right, strong. He's certainly a superior human being.
Please, don't kill me.
It was you.
I won't tell anyone, I swear.
Why don't you kill me, please? You think you can use me?
You cannot escape the power.
Again, the hype is a little over the top there, but it kind of gives you a little bit of an idea. One of the interesting things I found about this film before I start getting into the guts of what it's about is it's got a really interesting kind of bombastic score by Miklos Rocha, who was towards the end of his career, but was still doing some interesting stuff. I think it's very atypical for a 1960s movie soundtrack. I'll just play a little bit from the start of the film of Rocha's score, because I find it really kind of cool that George Pal is a producer, and Byron Haskin as a director made these choices to have his music in there, because it really does give it a slightly eerie feel. That strange instrument you hear is actually a cymbal on. It's a kind of hammered dulcimer. And I only know of a couple of people who ever used it in the 1960s in soundtracks. I know there's something very similar in some of John Barry's soundtracks for some more obscure spy films. And I know that other kind of similar instruments were used at various times. But it does give it a kind of terrific feel, particularly with that kind of throbbing bass beat behind it, which I kind of really like. It does take this film out of the usual, and that's one of the things George Pal did. The film had a very unhappy genesis. It was originally done as a television adaptation for Studio One in about 1956, and then, of course, for about 10 years it elapsed. Now, the MGM Studios announced that they were going to make this film with George Pal in 1964. The film itself wasn't released until 1968, but taking a look at it a bit closely, I think it may have been filmed somewhere around 1965, but held off being released for a few years. The cars, the fashions and things like that look a lot more like 1964-65 than they do 1968. And of course that soundtrack by Miklos Rocha very much is out of step with the contemporary feel of 1968. MGM had some hassles. They were slowly going broke in the 1960s, and they had a number of changes of management, which never helps the studio kind of stay steady and keep churning out the hits and the bucks. And George Pal didn't have a very happy relationship with them. He was a kind of visionary science fiction movie maker. He was, after Méliès, he was probably the first really big one to really embrace the genre. Of course, in the early 50s, he did things like The War of the Worlds, for instance. He also did Destination Moon. He did When Worlds Collide. In 1955, he did Conquest of Space. He did The Time Machine in 1960. He also did a few other interesting things in between, like The Naked Jungle with Charlton Heston, about the soldier ants. Fantastic action film. It's one of those great movies that people saw on a Sunday afternoon on television when there weren't too many video choices. But Pal was very much a visionary, and one of the unfortunate things was, first off, he had a lot of problems with studios. Studios didn't have faith in science fiction. These days, every hit a studio ever has is in some way science fiction, but in those days it wasn't. People were more into musicals and kind of comedies like Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson and Doris Day. They weren't genre friendly the way that cinema audiences are now. And of course, Pal had enormous trouble trying to get his projects through. And the other limitation, of course, that he had was the limitation of technology. Doing the special effects that George Pal required from his material, even a movie like this, if they remade it now, you could do some really interesting things using CGI and other techniques that are available there. And this movie, you really could have a go at doing a remake of it. I think it would work. The material is still fairly fresh, even though people don't believe in psychics anymore. You can kind of spin it in a certain way to make it work, but the limitations of the technology. I mean, I saw the Time Machine, the 1960 Time Machine. I watched that because I'm going to be talking about that on the radio next week. And one of the things that kind of wish had occurred was if the technology, special effects technology used in the recent 2004 time machine with Guy Pearce was available to George Powell and his crew in 1960, they would have had the perfect marriage of the two. They would have had Rod Taylor, of course, as the great scientist hero, and you would have had the special effects. Nowadays, the stop-motion effects look dated on it, but you could see how George Powell was struggling against limitations, and he was very much a hands-on guy. He started out doing stop-motion short subjects himself. He did some for advertising in England before he moved to America. Of course, they were running away from the Nazis, who's Hungarian. And then he did some short subjects that were very, very popular in Hollywood, which is how he got his entrance into the studio system. But he was always struggling against that limitation of telling a story with great special effects, against the limitation of the fact that special effects just weren't that great at the time. So I've got a great kind of admiration for Powell because of that. I think he struggled against the media he had available. And in doing so, he pushed through that limitation to try to bring interesting genre material to the public. And of course, any number of people love the stuff that he put out, with the possible exception of Doc Savage, Man of Bronze, which wasn't all that good. But having said, leaving that aside, it's an ambitious movie. It really is. A whole group of research scientists who are testing the limits of human endurance for the space program. One of the scientists gives out an intelligence test to all the people in the group of scientists because they want to kind of have some kind of a baseline for these, for the testing, and find out that one of them is an off the chart super genius to the point where manipulating other people is something he could do automatically. It's something he didn't even have to think about. He's an uber human in that sense. And of course, being the 1960s, psychic abilities were very much a flavor of the decade in a way. Telepathy, telekinesis, precognition, all that kind of stuff was a very kind of 1970s trope. The Russians and the Americans were experimenting with it for military advantage. Of course, nothing ever came of that apart from some very ugly experiments like MK Ultra. But they were actually taking this stuff seriously at the time. And of course, the genre works of the time really embraced it as well. If you look through the 1960s, it's full of telepaths and telekinetic people and all those sorts of things. So it was a very popular trope, but it was, to that era, what nanotechnology was to the noughties. So having said that, the group get together and they find this uber genius. And then as one by one, the scientists are getting killed off by this uber genius. They don't know who it is. It was a blind test on the IQ test. And they slowly realize that the genius is actually a person called Adam Hart, who has been trying to erase his past and has been systematically killing them off. One of them, Arthur O'Connell's character, very nervous scientist, is killed in a centrifuge. That's a really, really interesting scene because he's walking into his office and he's picking up some papers and doing some business. He's getting his paperwork together to prove that there's this super genius. Turns away from his door, the camera turns with him, turns back, and there's a blank wall in front of him. The door has disappeared from his perception. He's got no idea where the door is because his mind's being manipulated by Adam Hart, the super genius. And of course, Adam Hart, Adam being the first man, Hart is very important too, because one of the abilities Adam Hart has is the ability to make people's heart race and to kill them ultimately of heart attack. It kind of predates Cronenberg's scanners in a way. That manipulation of another person's metabolic systems at a distance is something that these two movies have in common. So, and as it goes on, of course, Jim Tanner, the character played by George Hamilton, who's not a particularly good actor, but you got to kind of roll with it in this kind of film. It's a chase movie as much as anything else, and he does an okay job at that kind of stuff. There's all of the paperwork regarding his academic achievement disappears and he's thrown out of the institute because they think he's a fake. For instance, again, this is more manipulation by Adam Hart. He tries to find out, he and his girlfriend, played by Suzanne Plachette, who's a lot more intelligent than he is, from the way she plays the role. She does a very good job of it. He doesn't particularly play an intelligent scientist particularly well, nor does one of the other scientists, played by Earl Holliman. It's kind of miscast somewhat on this one. But he goes out in the desert to try to find the origins of Adam Hart and finds a few booby traps that are left behind for people trying to track his history by Adam Hart. And the booby traps happen to be human beings. He programs human beings to defend him in a way. And it's really interesting as the story goes on, just the way the material surprises you sometimes. You're expecting a certain kind of chase movie, a certain kind of thing, and then they've got a thing like the wife of one of the scientists becomes a kind of lecherous alcoholic because you can tell she's been brain damaged by the psychic manipulations of Adam Hart. That's the character played by Yvonne DiCarlo in the movie. And it really does have these touches of unease and unusual events that really make you hunger for more in the movie. And of course the film does end up with Jim Tanner finding out which one of the characters is Adam Hart and finding out that he himself is not quite an ordinary human being. And that again makes for interesting viewing. And there's a psychic battle between the two, which is played out with stop motion in some parts of it and other kind of montage techniques of cinema to try to convey the fact that these two minds are working against each other. And Adam Hart is basically mind-fucking this guy and almost ruining his body as well as he tries to kill him. And for the movie at the time, I mean, how do you demonstrate someone invading another person's mind effectively with the special effects technologies and budgetary limitations of a 1960s film? And George Pal and his team really do attempt to address that. They do attempt to convey that shifting of reality that's caused by another person, one person manipulating another person's mind. And in a way, it's almost like a Phil Dick thing where reality isn't what the characters think it is and things change and the nature of reality and of human perception is very fluid because of that. And even though the film, as I said, isn't fantastically successful, MGM didn't really release it. They just kind of opened the door and let it wander off because of that studio politics that I mentioned earlier with George Pal not being really the kind of corporate player that they wanted people to be in the studio system as it was at the time. And that's one of the great unfortunate things. If he had have gone to, say, and made a film in France or something like that, I think that would have been an interesting thing because the French at the time were very much more open to playing edgy material. But Pal, liked Hollywood. He liked living there. He was very much fond of America because it had given him a sanctuary. And he stayed there for the rest of his life trying to get these projects off the ground. And if you go into his Wikipedia page, you can see all sorts of interesting projects that Pal did try to get off the ground. He tried to get Logan's Run made in 1968. It ended up being made in the mid-70s. He did an unfinished TV pilot for War of the Worlds. They were doing a sequel to When Worlds Collide, After Worlds Collide. They were doing an adaptation of Olaf Stapleton's Odd John. And they were doing a sequel to Doc Savage. He was looking at doing Wizard of Oz in 1979. And there were a bunch of other failed attempts at getting movies off the ground by George Pal, which is a bit of a shame because he always had that love of the genre. He always had that real ambition to tell fantastic stories and stories of science fiction and of fantasy and things like that. I mean, his adaptation of The Circus of Dr. Lowe, Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe, the adaptation of the Jack Finney novel, is still a fantastic film to see. And rereading the novel, you can kind of see that he hasn't strayed really far from the source material and that the Jack Finney novel is a difficult one to adapt. I reread it on my Kindle recently, and I could see it going as an HBO miniseries if they were going to remake it now. And I think it could be done. But to make that film in 1964 was quite an achievement. And of course, there are a number of special effects required to do so. So that's about it for The Power. I do have a movie poster of The Power, an original 1960s Australian Daybill poster. Daybills were an odd poster shape. They're the ones that are about 13 inches by 30 inches, the long, skinny movie posters, and they were lithographed, and the artwork on them is often quite primitive. But I've got one of the ones for The Power, and it's really great with a kind of stressed out George Hamilton's face in green, in tones of green in there. And it's one of the more striking science fiction posters that I've got in my collection. But anyway, that's about it for that. And I may just wrap up the first episode of the podcast here. But please offer feedback through the usual means, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, @gmail.com. You can also offer feedback through the voicemail line, which is for people in America more than people over here. And I always forget the number for that, so I'm just going to bring that up on the screen while I'm talking, because I can, in spite of what is said by some females I know, do two things at once. Not always very well, but I can. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. So that's about it for the Martian Drive-In podcast number one. Let me know what you think. I kind of had to bring this one together because of those scheduling problems a little bit quickly, so I haven't really kind of done the in-depth research I would have liked to on this, but we'll leave that aside. Next fortnight, we're going back to doing an episode of Paleo Cinema Podcast. So take care of yourselves, enjoy your movie viewing, watch the skies, and I'll be back with another Martian Drive-In podcast in a month's time. See ya.